mechanics, genetics, and evolutionary biology where this is not the case. I suspect that this situation will change as big data and intense computation increasingly encroach on all of science, and we aggressively attack some of the big questions, such as understanding the brain and consciousness, environmental sustainability, and cancer. However, I agree with Sidney Brenner, the distinguished biologist who received the Nobel Prize for his work on the genetic code, and who provocatively remarked that technology gives us the tools to analyze organisms at all scales, but we are drowning in a sea of data and thirsting for some theoretical framework with which to understand it. We need theory and a firm grasp on the nature of the objects we study to predict the rest. His article begins, by the way, with the astonishing pronouncement that biological research is in crisis. Many recognize the cultural divide between biology and physics. Nevertheless, we are witnessing an enormously exciting period as the two fields become more closely integrated, leading to new interdisciplinary subfields such as biological physics and systems biology. The time seems right for revisiting Darcy Thompson's challenge. How far, even then, mathematics will suffice to describe and physics to explain the fabric of the body, no man can foresee. It may be that all the laws of energy and all the properties of matter, all chemistry, are as powerless to explain the body as they are impotent to comprehend the soul. For my part, I think it is not so. Many would agree with the spirit of this remark, though new tools and concepts, including closer collaboration, may well be needed to accomplish his lofty goal. I would like to think that the marvelously enjoyable collaboration between Jim, Brian, and me, and all of our colleagues, postdocs, and students, has contributed just a little bit to this vision. 8. Network Principles and the Origins of Allometric Scaling. Prior to this digression into the interrelationship between the cultures of biology and physics, I argued that the mechanistic origins of scaling laws in biology were rooted in the universal, mathematical, dynamical, and organizational properties of the multiple networks that distribute energy, materials, and information to local macroscopic sites that permeate organisms, such as cells and mitochondria in animals. I also argued that because the structures of biological networks are so varied and stand in marked contrast to the uniformity of the scaling laws, their generic properties must be independent of their specific evolved design. In other words, there must be a common set of network properties that transcends whether they are constructed of tubes, as in mammalian circulatory systems, fibers, as in plants and trees, or diffusive pathways, as in cells. Formulating a set of general network principles and distilling out the essential features that transcend the huge diversity of biological networks proved to be a major challenge that took many months to resolve. As is often the case when moving into uncharted territory and trying to develop new ideas and ways of looking at a problem, the final product seems so obvious once the discovery or breakthrough has been made. It's hard to believe that it took so long, and one wonders why it couldn't have been done in just a few days. The frustrations and inefficiencies, the blind alleys, and the occasional eureka moments are all part and parcel of the creative process. There seems to be a natural gestation period, and this is simply the nature of the beast. However, once the problem comes into focus and it's been solved, it is extremely satisfying and enormously exciting. This was our collective experience in deriving our explanation for the origin of allometric scaling laws. Once the dust had settled, we proposed the following set of generic network properties that are presumed to have emerged as a result of the process of natural selection, and which give rise to quarter-power scaling laws when translated into mathematics. In thinking about them, it might be useful to reflect on their possible analogues in cities, economies, companies, and corporations, to which we will turn in some detail in later chapters. 1. Space filling. The idea behind the concept of space filling is simple and intuitive. Roughly speaking, it means that the tentacles of the network have to extend everywhere throughout the system that it is serving. More specifically, whatever the geometry and topology of the network is, it must service all local biologically active subunits of the organism or subsystem. A familiar example will make it clear. Our circulatory system is a classic hierarchical branching network, in which the heart pumps blood through the many levels of the network, beginning with the main arteries, passing through vessels of regularly decreasing size, ending with the capillaries, the smallest ones, before looping back to the heart through the venal network system. Space filling is simply the statement that the capillaries, which are the terminal units or last branch of the network, have to service every cell in our body, so as to efficiently supply each of them with sufficient blood and oxygen. Actually, all that is required is for capillaries to be close enough to cells for sufficient oxygen to diffuse efficiently across capillary walls, and thence through the outer membranes of the cells. Quite analogously, many of the infrastructural networks in cities are also space-filling. For example, the terminal units or endpoints of the utility networks, gas, water, and electricity, have to end up supplying all of the various buildings that constitute a city. The pipe that connects your house to the water line in the street and the electrical line that connects it to the main cable are analogues of capillaries, while your house can be thought of as an analogue to cells. Similarly, all employees of a company, viewed as terminal units, have to be supplied by resources, wages for example, and information through multiple networks connecting them with the CEO and the management. 2. The invariance of terminal units. This simply means that the terminal units of a given network design, such as the capillaries of the circulatory system that we just discussed, all have approximately the same size and characteristics, regardless of the size of the organism. Terminal units are critical elements of the network because they are points of delivery and transmission where energy and resources are exchanged. Other examples are mitochondria within cells, cells within bodies, and petioles, the last branch of plants and trees. As individuals grow from newborn to adult, or as new species of varying sizes evolve, terminal units do not get reinvented, nor are they significantly reconfigured or rescaled. For example, the capillaries of all mammals, whether children, adults, mice, elephants, or whales, are essentially all the same, despite the enormous range and variation of body sizes. This invariance of terminal units can be understood in the context of the parsimonious nature of natural selection. Capillaries, mitochondria, cells, etc. act as ready-made basic building blocks of the corresponding networks for new species, which are rescaled accordingly. The invariant properties of the terminal units within a specific design characterize the taxonomic class. For instance, all mammals share the same capillaries. Different species within that class, such as elephants, humans, and mice, are distinguished from one another by having larger or smaller, but closely related, network configurations. From this perspective, the difference between taxonomic groups, that is, between mammals, plants, and fish, for example, is characterized by different properties of the terminal units of their various corresponding networks. Thus, while all mammals share similar capillaries and mitochondria, as do all fish, the mammalian ones differ from those of fish in their size and overall characteristics. Analogously, the terminal units of networks that service and sustain buildings in a city, such as electrical outlets or water faucets, are also approximately invariant. For example, the electrical outlets in your house are essentially identical to those of almost any building anywhere in the world, no matter how big or small it is. There may be small local variations in detailed design, but they are all pretty much the same size. Even though the Empire State Building in New York City and many other similar buildings in Dubai, Shanghai, or Sao Paulo may be more than 50 times taller than your house, all of them, including your house, share outlets and faucets that are very similar. If outlet size was naively scaled isometrically with the height of buildings, then a typical electrical outlet in the Empire State Building would have to be more than 50 times larger than the ones in your house, which means it would be more than 10 feet tall and 3 feet wide, rather than just a few inches. And as in biology, basic terminal units, such as faucets and electrical outlets, are not reinvented every time we design a new building, regardless of where or how big it is. 3. Optimization. The final postulate states that the continuous multiple feedback and fine-tuning mechanisms implicit in the ongoing processes of natural selection, and which have been playing out over enormous periods of time, have led to the network performance being optimized. So, for example, the energy used by the heart of any mammal, including us, to pump blood through the circulatory system is, on average, minimized. That is, it is the smallest it could possibly be, given its design and the various network constraints. To put it slightly differently, of the infinite number of possibilities for the architecture and dynamics of circulatory systems that could have evolved, and that are space-filling with invariant terminal units, the ones that actually did evolve and are shared by all mammals minimize cardiac output. Networks have evolved so that the energy needed to sustain an average individual's life and perform the mundane tasks of living is minimized in order to maximize the amount of energy available for sex, reproduction, and the raising of offspring. This maximization of offspring is an expression of what is referred to as Darwinian fitness, which is the genetic contribution of an average individual to the next generation's gene pool. This naturally raises the question as to whether the dynamics and structure of cities and companies are the result of analogous optimization principles. What, if anything, is optimized in their multiple network systems? Are cities organized to maximize social interactions, or to optimize transport by minimizing mobility times? Or are they ultimately driven by the ambition of each citizen and company to maximize their assets, profits, and wealth? I will return to these issues in chapters 8, 9, and 10. Optimization principles lie at the very heart of all of the fundamental laws of nature, whether Newton's laws, Maxwell's electromagnetic theory, quantum mechanics, Einstein's theory of relativity, or the grand unified theories of the elementary particles. Their modern formulation is a general mathematical framework in which a quantity called the action, which is loosely related to energy, is minimized. All the laws of physics can be derived from the principle of least action, which, roughly speaking, states that of all the possible configurations that a system can have, or that it can follow as it evolves in time, the one that is physically realized is the one that minimizes its action. Consequently, the dynamics, structure, and time evolution of the universe since the Big Bang, everything from black holes and the satellites transmitting your cell phone messages to the cell phones and messages themselves, all electrons, photons, Higgs particles, and pretty much everything else that is physical, are determined from such an optimization principle. So why not life? This question returns us to our earlier discussion concerning the differences between simplicity and complexity. You may recall that almost all the laws of physics come under the umbrella of simplicity, primarily because they can be expressed in a parsimonious way in terms of just a few compact mathematical equations, such as Newton's laws, Maxwell's equations, Einstein's theory of relativity, and so on. all of which can be formulated and elegantly derived from the principle of least action. This is one of the crowning achievements of science, and has contributed enormously to our understanding of the world around us and to the remarkable development of our modern technological society. Is it conceivable that the coarse-grained dynamics and structure of complex adaptive systems, whether organisms, cities, or companies, could be analogously formulated and derived from such a principle? It is important to recognize that the three postulates enunciated above are to be understood in a coarse-grained, average sense. Let me explain. It may have occurred to you that there must be variation among the almost trillion capillaries in any individual human body, as there must be across all the species of a given taxonomic group. So, strictly speaking, capillaries cannot be invariant. However, this variation has to be viewed in a relative scale-dependent way. The point is that any variation among capillaries is extremely small compared with the many orders of magnitude variation in body size. For instance, even if the length of mammalian capillaries varied by a factor of 2, this is still tiny compared with the factor of 100 million in the variation of their body masses. Similarly, there is relatively little variation in petioles, the last branch of a tree prior to the leaf, or even in the size of leaves themselves during the growth of a tree from a tiny sapling to a mature tree that might be 100 or more feet high. This is also true across species of trees. Leaves do vary in size, but by a relatively small factor, despite huge factors in the variation of their heights and masses. A tree that is just 20 times taller than another does not have leaves whose diameter is 20 times larger. Consequently, the variation among terminal units within a given design is a relatively small secondary effect. The same goes for possible variations in the other postulates. Networks may not be precisely space-filling or precisely optimized. Corrections due to such deviations and variations are considered to be higher-order effects, in the sense we discussed earlier. These postulates underlie the zeroth order, coarse-grained theory for the structure, organization, and dynamics of biological networks, and allow us to calculate many of the essential features of what I referred to as the average idealized organism of a given size. In order to carry out this strategy and calculate quantities such as metabolic rates, growth rates, the heights of trees, or the number of mitochondria in a cell, these postulates have to be translated into mathematics. The goal is to determine the consequences, ramifications, and predictions of the theory, and confront them with data and observations. The details of the mathematics depend on the specific kind of network being considered. As discussed earlier, our circulatory system is a network of pipes driven by a beating heart, whereas plants and trees are networks of bundles of thin fibers driven by a steady, non-pulsatile hydrostatic pressure. Fundamental to the conceptual framework of the theory is that, despite these completely different physical designs, both kinds of networks are constrained by the same three postulates. They are space-filling, have invariant terminal units, and minimize the energy needed to pump fluid through the system. Carrying out this strategy proved to be quite a challenge, both conceptually and technically. It took almost a year to iron out all of the details, but ultimately we showed how Kleiber's law for metabolic rates, and indeed quarter-power scaling in general, arises from the dynamics and geometry of optimized space-filling branching networks. Perhaps most satisfying was to show how the magic number 4 arises and where it comes from. In the following subsections, I am going to translate the mathematics of how all of this comes about into English to give you an insight into some surprising ways that our bodies work and how we are intimately related, not only to all of life, but to the entire physical world around us. This was an extraordinary experience that I hope you'll find as fascinating and exciting as I did. Equally satisfying was to extend this framework to address all sorts of other problems, such as forests, sleep, rates of evolution, and aging and mortality, some of which I will turn to in the following chapter. 9. Metabolic rate and circulatory systems in mammals, plants, and trees. As was explained earlier, oxygen is crucial for maintaining the continuous supply of ATP molecules that are the basic currency of the metabolic energy that keeps us alive. That's why we have to be continuously breathing. Inhaled oxygen is transported across the surface membranes of our lungs, which are suffused with capillaries, where it is absorbed by our blood and pumped through the cardiovascular system to be delivered to our cells. Oxygen molecules bind to the iron-rich hemoglobin in blood cells, which act as the carriers of oxygen. It is this oxidation process that is responsible for our blood being red, in much the same way that iron turns red when it oxidizes to rust in the atmosphere. After the blood has delivered its oxygen to the cells, it loses its red color and turns bluish, which is why veins, which are the vessels that return blood back to the heart and lungs, look blue. The rate at which oxygen is delivered to cells, and likewise the rate at which blood is pumped through our circulatory system, are therefore measures of our metabolic rate. Similarly, the rate at which oxygen is inhaled through our mouths and into the respiratory system is also a measure of metabolic rate. These two systems are tightly coupled together, so blood flow rates, respiratory rates, and metabolic rates are all proportional to one another and related by simple linear relationships. Thus, hearts beat approximately 4 times for each breath that is inhaled, regardless of the size of the mammal. This tight coupling of the oxygen delivery systems is why the properties of the cardiovascular and respiratory networks play such an important role in determining and constraining metabolic rate. The rate at which you use energy to pump blood through the vasculature of your circulatory system is called your cardiac power output. This energy expenditure is used to overcome the viscous drag or friction on blood as it flows through increasingly narrower and narrower vessels in its journey through the aorta, which is the first artery leaving your heart, down through multiple levels of the network to the tiny capillaries that feed cells. A human aorta is an approximately cylindrical pipe that is about 18 inches long, about 45 centimeters, and about an inch, about 2.5 centimeters in diameter, whereas our capillaries are only about 5 micrometers wide, about 1/100 of an inch, which is somewhat smaller than a hair breadth. Although a blue whale's aorta is almost 1 foot in diameter, 30 centimeters, its capillaries are still pretty much the same size as yours and mine. This is an explicit example of the invariance of the terminal units in these networks. It's much harder to push fluid through a narrow tube than a wider one, so almost all of the energy that your heart expends is used to push blood through the tiniest vessels at the end of the network. It's a bit like having to push juice through a sieve, in this case, one that is made up of about 10 billion little holes. On the other hand, you use relatively little energy pumping blood through your arteries, or indeed through any of the other larger tubes in the network, even though that's where most of your blood resides. One of the basic postulates of our theory is that the network configuration has evolved to minimize cardiac output, that is, the energy needed to pump blood through the system. For an arbitrary network where the flow is driven by a pulsatile pump such as our hearts, there is another potential source of energy loss in addition to that associated with the viscous drag of blood flowing through capillaries and smaller vessels. This is a subtle effect arising from its pulsatile nature, and nicely illustrates the beauty of the design of our cardiovascular system that has resulted from optimizing its performance. When blood leaves the heart, it travels down through the aorta in a wave motion that is generated by the beating of the heart. The frequency of this wave is synchronous with your heart rate, which is about 60 beats a minute. The aorta branches into two arteries, and when blood reaches this first branch point, some of it flows down one tube and some down the other, both in a wave-like motion. A generic feature of waves is that they suffer reflections when they meet a barrier, a mirror being the most obvious example. Light is an electromagnetic wave, so the image that you see is just the reflection from the surface of the mirror of the light waves that originate from your body. Other familiar examples are the reflection of water waves from a barrier, or an echo in which sound waves are reflected from a hard surface. In a similar fashion, the blood wave traveling along the aorta is partially reflected back when it meets the branch point, the remainder being transmitted down through the daughter arteries. These reflections have potentially very bad consequences, because they mean that your heart is effectively pumping against itself. Furthermore, this effect gets hugely enhanced as blood flows down through the hierarchy of vessels, because the same phenomenon occurs at each ensuing branch point in the network, resulting in a large amount of energy being expended by your heart just in overcoming these multiple reflections. This would be an extremely inefficient design, resulting in a huge burden on the heart and a huge waste of energy. To avoid this potential problem and minimize the work our hearts have to do, the geometry of our circulatory systems has evolved so that there are no reflections at any branch point throughout the network. The mathematics and physics of how this is accomplished is a little bit complicated, but the result is simple and elegant. The theory predicts that there will be no reflections at any branch point if the sum of the cross-sectional areas of the daughter tubes leaving the branch point is the same as the cross-sectional area of the parent tube coming into it. As an example, consider the simple case where the two daughter tubes are identical, and therefore have the same cross-sectional areas, which is approximately correct in real circulatory systems. Suppose that the cross-sectional area of the parent tube is 2 square inches. Then, in order to ensure that there are no reflections, the cross-sectional area of each daughter has to be 1 square inch. Because the cross-sectional area of any vessel is proportional to the square of its radius, another way of expressing this result is to say that the square of the radius of the parent tube has to be just twice the square of the radius of each of the daughters. So, to ensure that there is no energy loss via reflections as one progresses down the network, the radii of successive vessels must scale in a regular, self-similar fashion, decreasing by a constant factor of the square root of 2 with each successive branching. This so-called area-preserving branching is, indeed, how our circulatory system is constructed, as has been confirmed by detailed measurements across many mammals and many plants and trees. This at first seems quite surprising, given that plants and trees do not have beating hearts. The flow through their vasculature is steady and non-pulsatile, yet their vasculature scales just like the pulsatile circulatory system. However, if you think of a tree as a bundle of fibers all tightly tied together, beginning in the trunk and then sequentially spraying out up through its branches, then it's clear that the cross-sectional area must be preserved all the way up through the hierarchy. This is illustrated below, where this fiber bundle structure is compared with the pipe structure of mammals. An interesting consequence of area-preserving branching is that the cross-sectional area of the trunk is the same as the sum of the cross-sectional areas of all the tiny branches at the end of the network, the petioles. Amazingly, this was known to Leonardo da Vinci. Although this simple geometric picture demonstrates why trees obey area-preserving branching, it is, in actuality, an oversimplification. However, area preserving can be derived from a much more realistic model for trees using the general network principles of space filling and optimization enunciated above, supplemented with biomechanical constraints that require branches to be resilient against perturbations from wind by bending without breaking. Such an analysis shows that in almost all respects, plants and trees scale just like mammals, both within individuals as well as across species, including the three-quarters power law for their metabolic rates, even though their physical design is quite different. 10. Digression on Nikola Tesla, impedance matching, and AC/DC. It's a lovely thought that the optimum design of our circulatory system obeys the same simple area-preserving branching rules that trees and plants do. It's equally satisfying that the condition of non-reflectivity of waves at branch points in pulsatile networks is essentially identical to how national power grids are designed for the efficient transmission of electricity over long distances. This condition of non-reflectivity is called impedance matching. It has multiple applications, not only in the working of your body, but across a very broad spectrum of technologies that play an important part in your daily life. For example, telephone network systems use matched impedances to minimize echoes on long-distance lines. Most loudspeaker systems and musical instruments contain impedance-matching mechanisms, and the bones in the middle ear provide impedance matching between the eardrum and the inner ear. If you have ever witnessed or been subject to an ultrasound examination, you will be familiar with the nurse or technician smearing a gooey gel over your skin before sliding the probe over it. You probably thought that this was for lubrication purposes, but in fact, it's actually for matching impedances. Without the gel, the impedance mismatch in ultrasound detection would result in almost all of the energy being reflected back from the skin, leaving very little to go into the body to be reflected back from the organ or fetus under investigation. The term impedance matching can be a very useful metaphor for connoting important aspects of social interactions. For example, the smooth and efficient functioning of social networks, whether in a society, a company, a group activity, and especially in relationships such as marriages and friendships, requires good communication in which information is faithfully transmitted between groups and individuals. When information is dissipated or reflected, such as when one side is not listening, it cannot be faithfully or efficiently processed, inevitably leading to a misinterpretation, a process analogous to the loss of energy when impedances are not matched. As we became more and more reliant on electricity as a major source of power, the necessity for transmitting it across long distances became a matter of some urgency as the 19th century progressed. Not surprisingly, Thomas Edison was a major player in thinking about how this could be accomplished. He subsequently became the great proponent of direct current, DC, transmission. You are probably familiar with the idea that electricity comes in two major varieties. Direct current, DC, beloved of Edison, in which electricity flows in a continuous fashion like a river, and alternating current, AC, in which it flows in a pulsatile wave motion, much like ocean waves or the blood in your arteries. Until the 1880s, all commercial electrical current was DC, partly because AC electrical motors had not yet been invented, and partly because most transmission was over relatively short distances. However, there were good scientific reasons for favoring AC transmission, especially for long distances, not least of which is that one can take advantage of its pulsatile nature and match impedances at branch nodes in the power grid so as to minimize power loss, just as we do in our circulatory system. The invention of the AC induction motor and transformer in 1886 by the brilliant charismatic inventor and futurist Nikola Tesla marked a turning point and signaled the beginning of the War of Currents. In the United States, this turned into a battle royal between the Thomas Edison Company, later General Electric, and the George Westinghouse Company. Ironically, Tesla had come to the United States from his native Serbia to work for Edison to perfect DC transmission. Despite his success in this endeavor, he moved on to develop the superior AC system, ultimately selling his patents to Westinghouse. Although AC eventually won out and now dominates electrical transmission globally, DC persisted well into the 20th century. I grew up in houses in England with DC electricity, and well remember when our neighborhood was converted to AC and we joined the 20th century. You have no doubt heard of Nikola Tesla primarily because his name was co-opted by the much-publicized automobile company that produces sleek, upscale electric cars. Until recently, he had been all but forgotten except by physicists and electrical engineers. He was famous in his lifetime not only for his major achievements in electrical engineering technology, but for his somewhat wild ideas and outrageous showmanship. So much so that he made it onto the cover of Time magazine. His research and speculations on lightning, death rays, and improving intelligence via electrical impulses, as well as his photographic memory, his apparent lack of the need for sleep or close human relationship, and his Central European accent, led him to become the prototype of the mad scientist. Although his patents earned him a considerable fortune, which he used to fund his own research, he died destitute in New York in 1943. Over the last 20 years, his name has experienced a major resurgence in the popular culture, culminating, fittingly, in its use for the automobile company. 11. Back to metabolic rate, beating hearts, and circulatory systems. The theoretical framework discussed in the previous sections explains how cardiovascular systems scale across species, from the shrew to the blue whale. Equally important, it also explains how they scale within an average individual, from the aorta to the capillaries. So, if for some perverse reason you wanted to know the radius, length, blood flow rate, pulse rate, velocity, pressure, etc., in the 14th branch of the circulatory system of the average hippopotamus, the theory will provide you with the answer. In fact, the theory will tell you the answer for any of these quantities for any branch of the network in any animal. As blood flows through smaller and smaller vessels, on its way down through the network, viscous drag forces become increasingly important, leading to the dissipation of more and more energy. The effect of this energy loss is to progressively dampen the wave on its way down through the network hierarchy, until it eventually loses its pulsatile character and turns into a steady flow. In other words, the nature of the flow makes a transition from being pulsatile in the larger vessels to being steady in the smaller ones. That's why you feel a pulse only in your main arteries. There's almost no vestige of it in your smaller vessels. In the language of electrical transmission, the nature of the blood flow changes from being AC to DC as it progresses down through the network. Thus, by the time blood reaches the capillaries, its viscosity ensures that it is no longer pulsatile, and that it is moving extremely slowly. It slows down to a speed of only about 1 millimeter per second, which is tiny compared with its speed of 40 centimeters per second when it leaves the heart. This is extremely important, because this leisurely speed ensures that oxygen carried by the blood has sufficient time to diffuse efficiently across the walls of the capillaries and be rapidly delivered to feed cells. Interestingly, the theory predicts that these velocities at the two extremities of the network, the capillaries and the aorta, are the same for all mammals, as observed. You are very likely aware of this huge difference in speeds between capillaries and the aorta. If you prick your skin, blood oozes out very slowly from the capillaries, with scant resulting damage. Whereas if you cut a major artery such as your aorta, carotid, or femoral, blood gushes out, and you can die in just a matter of minutes. But what's really surprising is that blood pressures are also predicted to be the same across all mammals, regardless of their size. Thus, despite the shrew's heart weighing only about 12 milligrams, the equivalent of about 25 grains of salt, and its aorta having a radius of only about 0.1 millimeter and consequently barely visible, whereas a whale's heart weighs about a ton, almost the weight of a Mini Cooper, and its aorta has a radius of about 30 centimeters, their blood pressures are approximately the same. This is pretty amazing. Just think of the enormous stresses on the walls of the shrew's tiny aorta and arteries, compared with the pressures on yours and mine, let alone those on a whale's. No wonder the poor creature dies after only a year or two. The first person to study the physics of blood flow was the polymath Thomas Young. In 1808, he derived the formula for how its velocity depends on the density and elasticity of the arterial walls. His seminal results were of great importance in paving the way for understanding how the cardiovascular system works, and for using measurements on pulse waves and blood velocities to probe and diagnose cardiovascular disease. For example, as we age, our arteries harden, leading to significant changes in their density and elasticity, and therefore to predictable changes in the flow and pulse velocity of the blood. In addition to his work on the cardiovascular system, Young was famous for several other quite diverse and profound discoveries. He is perhaps best known for establishing the wave theory of light, in which each color is associated with a particular wavelength. But he also contributed to early work in linguistics and Egyptian hieroglyphics, including being the first person to decipher the famous Rosetta Stone, now sitting in the British Museum in London. As a fitting tribute to this remarkable man, Andrew Robinson wrote a spirited biography of Young titled The Last Man Who Knew Everything, Thomas Young, the Anonymous Polymath Who Proved Newton Wrong, Explained How We See, Cured the Sick, and deciphered the Rosetta Stone, among other feats of genius. I have a certain soft spot for Young because he was born in Milverton, in the county of Somerset in the west of England, just a few short miles from Taunton, where I was born. 12. Self-similarity and the origin of the magic number 4. Most biological networks, like the circulatory system, exhibit the intriguing geometric property of being a fractal. You're probably familiar with the idea. Simply put, fractals are objects that look approximately the same at all scales, or at any level of magnification. A classic example is a cauliflower or a head of broccoli. Fractals are ubiquitous throughout nature, appearing everywhere from lungs and ecosystems to cities, companies, clouds, and rivers. I want to spend this section elaborating on what they are, what they mean, how they are related to power law scaling, and how they are manifested in the circulatory system that we have been discussing. If broccoli is broken into smaller pieces, each piece looks like a reduced size version of the original. When scaled back up to the size of the whole, each piece appears indistinguishable from the original. If each of these smaller pieces is likewise broken into even smaller pieces, then these two look like reduced size versions of the original broccoli. You can imagine repeating this process over and over again with basically the same result, namely that each subunit looks like a scaled down version of the original whole. To put it slightly differently, if you took a photograph of any of the pieces of broccoli, whatever their size, and blew it up to the size of the original head, you would have a difficult time telling the difference between the blown-up version and the original. Without an absolute scale, the similarities of a tree in winter to a dried leaf or our circulatory system are obvious. The Grand Canyon could just as well be erosion along the dirt roadway to my house after the runoff following a big storm. This is in marked contrast to what we normally see when, for example, we use a microscope to zoom in on an object using a higher and higher resolution in order to reveal greater detail and new structure that is qualitatively different from those of the whole. Obvious examples are cells in tissue, molecules in materials, or protons in atoms. If, on the other hand, the object is a fractal, no new pattern or detail arises when the resolution is increased. The same pattern repeats itself over and over again. In reality, this is an idealized description. For, of course, the images at various levels of resolution differ very slightly from one another, and eventually the recursive repetition ceases, and new patterns of structural design appear. If you continue breaking down broccoli to increasingly smaller pieces, these eventually lose the geometric characteristics of broccoli, and eventually reveal the structure of its tissue, its cells, and its molecules. This repetitive phenomenon is called self-similarity, and is a generic characteristic of fractals. Analogous to the repetitive scaling exhibited by broccoli are the infinite reflections in parallel mirrors, or the nesting of Russian dolls, matryoshka, of regularly decreasing sizes inside one another. Long before the concept was invented, self-similarity was poetically expressed by the Irish satirist Jonathan Swift, the author of Gulliver's Travels, in this whimsical quatrain. So naturalists observe a flea hath smaller fleas that on him prey, and these have smaller still to bite him, and so proceed ad infinitum. So it is with the hierarchical networks we have been discussing. If you cut a piece out of such a network and appropriately scale it up, then the resulting network looks just like the original. Locally, each level of the network essentially replicates a scaled version of the levels adjacent to it. We saw an explicit example of this when discussing the consequences of impedance matching in the pulsatile regime of the circulatory system, where area-preserving branching resulted in the radii of successive vessels decreasing by a constant factor. The square root of 2 equals 1.41 with each successive branching. So, for example, if we compare the radii of vessels separated by 10 such branchings, then they are related by a scale factor of the square root of 2 to the 10th equals 32. Because our aorta has a radius of about 1.5 centimeters, this means that the radii of vessels at the 10th branching level are only about half a millimeter. Because blood flow changes from pulsatile to non-pulsatile as one progresses down the network, our circulatory system is actually not continuously self-similar, nor therefore a precise fractal. In the non-pulsatile domain, where the flow is dominated by viscous forces, minimizing the amount of power being dissipated leads to a self-similarity, in which the radii of successive vessels decrease by a constant factor of the cube root of 2. Cube root of 2 equals 1.26, rather than the square root. Square root of 2 equals 1.41, as in the pulsatile region. Thus, the fractal nature of the circulatory system subtly changes from the aorta to the capillaries, reflecting the change in the nature of the flow from pulsatile to non-pulsatile. Trees, on the other hand, maintain approximately the same self-similarity from the trunk to their leaves, with radii successively decreasing by the area-preserving ratio of the square root of 2. The space-filling requirement that the network must service the entire volume of the organism at all scales also requires it to be self-similar in terms of the lengths of the vessels. To fill the three-dimensional space, lengths of successive vessels have to decrease by a constant factor of the cube root of 2, with each successive branching. And, in contrast to radii, this remains valid down through the entire network, including both the pulsatile and non-pulsatile domains. Having determined how networks scale within individuals following these simple rules, the last piece of the derivation is to determine how this connects across species of different weights. This is accomplished from a further consequence of the energy minimization principle, namely, that the total volume of the network, that is, the total volume of blood in the body, must be directly proportional to the volume of the body itself, and therefore proportional to its weight, as observed. In other words, the volume of blood is a constant proportion of the volume of the body, regardless of size. For a tree, this is obvious, because the network of its vessels constitutes the entire tree. There is no analogue of flesh in between all of its branches, so the volume of the network is the volume of the tree. Now, the volume of the network is just the sum of the volumes of all of its vessels or branches, and these can be straightforwardly calculated from knowing how their lengths and radii scale, thereby connecting the self-similarity of the internal network to body size. It is the mathematical interplay between the cube root scaling law for lengths and the square root scaling law for radii, constrained by the linear scaling of blood volume and the invariance of the terminal units, that leads to quarter power allometric exponents across organisms. The resulting magic number 4 emerges as an effective extension of the usual 3 dimensions of the volume serviced by the network by an additional dimension resulting from the fractal nature of the network. I shall go into this in more detail in the following chapter, where I discuss the general concept of fractal dimension. But suffice it to say here that natural selection has taken advantage of the mathematical marvels of fractal networks to optimize their distribution of energy, so that organisms operate as if they were in 4 dimensions, rather than the canonical 3. In this sense, the ubiquitous number 4 is actually 3+1. More generally, it is the dimension of the space being serviced, +1. So, had we lived in a universe of 11 dimensions, as some of my string theory friends believe, the magic number would have been 11+1=12. And we would have been talking about the universality of 1/12th power scaling laws rather than 1/4 power ones. 13. Fractals. The mysterious case of the lengthening borders. Mathematicians had recognized for a long time that there were geometries that lay outside of the canonical boundaries of the classical Euclidean geometry that has formed the basis for mathematics and physics since ancient times. The traditional framework that many of us have been painfully and joyfully exposed to implicitly assumes that all lines and surfaces are smooth and continuous. Novel ideas that evoked concepts of discontinuities and crinkliness, which are implicit in the modern concept of fractals, were viewed as fascinating formal extensions of academic mathematics, but were not generally perceived as playing any significant role in the real world. It fell to the French mathematician Benoît Mandelbrot to make the crucial insight that, quite to the contrary, crinkliness, discontinuity, roughness and self-similarity, in a word, fractality, are in fact ubiquitous features of the complex world we live in. In retrospect, it is quite astonishing that this insight had eluded the greatest mathematicians, physicists and philosophers for more than 2,000 years. Like many great leaps forward, Mandelbrot's insight now seems almost obvious, and it beggars belief that his observation hadn't been made hundreds of years earlier. After all, natural philosophy has been one of the major categories of human intellectual endeavor for a very long time, and almost everyone is familiar with cauliflowers, vascular networks, streams, rivers, and mountain ranges, all of which are now perceived as being fractal. However, almost no one had conceived of their structural and organizational regularities in general terms, nor the mathematical language used to describe them. Perhaps, like the erroneous Aristotelian assumption that heavier things obviously fall faster, the Platonic ideal of smoothness embodied in classical Euclidean geometry, was so firmly ingrained in our psyches that it had to wait a very long time for someone to actually check that it was valid with real-life examples. That person was an unusual British polymath named Lewis Fry Richardson, who almost accidentally laid the foundation for inspiring Mandelbrot's invention of fractals. The tale of how Richardson came to this is an unusually interesting one, which I shall recount very briefly. Mandelbrot's insights imply that, when viewed through a coarse-grained lens of varying resolution, a hidden simplicity and regularity is revealed underlying the extraordinary complexity and diversity in much of the world around us. Furthermore, the mathematics that describes self-similarity and its implicit recursive rescaling is identical to the power law scaling discussed in previous chapters. In other words, power law scaling is the mathematical expression of self-similarity and fractality. Consequently, because animals obey power law scaling both within individuals, in terms of the geometry and dynamics of their internal network structures, as well as across species, they, and therefore all of us, are living manifestations of self-similar fractals. Lewis Fry Richardson was a mathematician, physicist, and meteorologist who, at the age of 46, also earned a degree in psychology. He was born in 1881, and early in his career made seminal contributions to our modern methodology of weather forecasting. He pioneered the idea of computationally modeling the weather using the fundamental equations of hydrodynamics, the Navier-Stokes equations introduced earlier when discussing the modeling of ships, augmented and updated with continuous feedback from real-time weather data, such as changes in air pressure, temperature, density, humidity, and wind velocity. He conceived this strategy early in the 20th century, well before the development of modern high-speed computers, so his computations had to be carried out painfully, slowly, by hand, resulting in very limited predictive power. Nevertheless, this strategy, and the general mathematical techniques he developed, provided the foundation for science-based forecasts, and pretty much formed the template now used to give us relatively accurate weather forecasts for up to several weeks into the future. The advent of high-speed computers, coupled with almost minute-by-minute updating from huge amounts of local data gathered across the globe, has enormously improved our ability to forecast weather. Both Richardson and Mandelbrot came from relatively unusual backgrounds. Although both were trained in mathematics, neither followed a standard academic career path. Richardson, who was a Quaker, had been a conscientious objector during the First World War, and was consequently prevented from having any subsequent university academic position, a rule that might strike us today as particularly vindictive. And Mandelbrot did not get his first tenured professorial appointment until he was 75 years old, thereby becoming the oldest professor in Yale's history to receive tenure. Perhaps it requires outliers and mavericks like Richardson and Mandelbrot working outside mainstream research to revolutionize our way of seeing the world. Richardson had worked for the British Meteorological Office before the war, and rejoined it after the war ended, only to resign his post a couple of years later, again on conscientious grounds, when the office became part of the Air Ministry in charge of the Royal Air Force. It is curiously fitting that his deeply felt pacifism and consequent fringe connection to the world of mainstream academic research led to his most interesting and seminal observation, namely that measuring lengths isn't as simple as it might appear, thereby bringing to consciousness the role of fractals in our everyday world. To appreciate how he came to this, I need to make a small detour into his other accomplishments. Stimulated by his passionate pacifism, Richardson embarked on an ambitious program to develop a quantitative theory for understanding the origins of war and international conflict in order to devise a strategy for their ultimate prevention. His aim was nothing less than to develop a science of war. His main thesis was that the dynamics of conflict are primarily governed by the rates at which nations build up their armaments, and that their continued accumulation is the major cause of war. He viewed the accumulation of weapons as a proxy for the collective psychosocial forces that reflect, but transcend, history, politics, economics, and culture, and whose dynamics inevitably lead to conflict and instability. Richardson used the mathematics developed for understanding chemical reaction dynamics and the spread of communicable diseases to model the ever-increasing escalation of arms races, in which the arsenal of each country increases in response to the increase in armaments of every other country. His theory did not attempt to explain the fundamental origins of war, that is, why we collectively resort to force and violence to settle our conflicts, but rather to show how the dynamics of arms races escalate, resulting in catastrophic conflict. Although his theory is highly oversimplified, Richardson had some success in comparing his analyses with data. But more important, he provided an alternative framework for quantitatively understanding the origins of war that could be confronted with data. Furthermore, it had the virtue of showing what parameters were important, especially in providing scenarios under which a potentially peaceful situation could be achieved and sustained. In contrast to conventional, more qualitative theories of conflict, the roles of leadership, cultural and historical animosity, and specific events and personalities play no explicit role in his theory. In his desire to create a testable scientific framework, Richardson collected an enormous amount of historical data on wars and conflicts. In order to quantify them, he introduced a general concept, which he called the deadly quarrel, defined as any violent conflict between human beings resulting in death. War is then viewed as a particular case of a deadly quarrel, but so is an individual murder. He quantified their magnitudes by the subsequent number of deaths. For an individual murder, the size of the deadly quarrel is therefore just one, whereas for the Second World War, it is more than 50 million, the exact number depending on how civilian casualties are counted. He then took the bold leap of asking whether there was a continuum of deadly quarrels, beginning with the individual and progressing up through gang violence, civil unrest, small conflicts, and ending up with the two major world wars, thereby covering a range of almost eight orders of magnitude. Trying to plot these on a single axis leads to the same challenge we faced earlier when trying to accommodate all earthquakes or all mammalian metabolic rates on a simple linear scale. Practically, it simply isn't possible, and one has to resort to using a logarithmic scale to see the entire spectrum of deadly quarrels. Thus, by analogy with the Richter scale, the Richardson scale begins with zero for a single individual murder and ends with a magnitude of almost eight for the two world wars. Eight orders of magnitude would represent 100 million deaths. In between, a small riot with 10 victims would have magnitude one. A skirmish in which 100 combatants were killed would be two, and so on. Obviously, there are very few wars of magnitude seven, but an enormous number of conflicts with magnitude zero or one. When he plotted the number of deadly quarrels of a given size versus their magnitude on a logarithmic scale, he found an approximately straight line, just like the straight lines we saw when physiological quantities like metabolic rate were plotted in this way versus animal size. Consequently, the frequency distribution of wars follows simple power law scaling, indicating that conflicts are approximately self-similar. This remarkable result leads to the surprising conclusion that, in a coarse-grained sense, a large war is just a scaled-up version of a small conflict, analogous to the way that elephants are approximately scaled-up mice. Thus underlying the extraordinary complexity of wars and conflicts seems to be a common dynamic operating across all scales. Recent work has confirmed such findings for recent wars, terrorist attacks, and even cyber attacks. No general theory has yet been advanced for understanding these regularities, though they very likely reflect the fractal-like network characteristics of national economies, social behavior, and competitive forces. In any case, any ultimate theory of war needs to account for them. This, at last, leads to the main point of telling the story of Lewis Richardson. He had viewed the power law scaling of conflicts as just one of potentially other systematic regularities concerning war from which he hoped to discover the general laws governing human violence. In trying to develop a theory, he hypothesized that the probability of war between neighboring states was proportional to the length of their common border. Driven by his passion to test his theory, he turned his attention to figuring out how the lengths of borders are measured, and in doing so, inadvertently discovered fractals. To test his idea, he set about collecting data on lengths of borders, and was surprised to discover that there was considerable variation in the published data. For example, he learned that the length of the border between Spain and Portugal was sometimes quoted as 987 kilometers, but other times as 1,214 kilometers, and similarly, that the border between the Netherlands and Belgium was sometimes 380 kilometers, and at other times 449 kilometers. It was hard to believe that such large discrepancies were errors in measurement. By that time, surveying was already a highly developed, well-established, and accurate science. For instance, the height of Mount Everest was known to within a few feet by the end of the 19th century. So discrepancies of hundreds of kilometers in the lengths of borders were totally weird. Clearly, something else was going on. Until Richardson's investigation, the methodology of measuring lengths was taken completely for granted. The idea seems so simple it's hard to see what could go wrong. Let's then analyze the process of how we measure lengths. Suppose you want to make a rough estimate of the length of your living room. This can be straightforwardly accomplished by laying down a meter stick end to end, in a straight line, and counting how many times it fits in between the walls. You discover that it takes just over 6 times, and so conclude that the room is roughly 6 meters long. Sometime later, you find that you need a more accurate estimate, and so use the finer-grained resolution of a 10-centimeter ruler to make the estimate. Carefully placing it end to end, you find that it takes just under 63 times to fit it across the room, leading to a more accurate approximation for its length of 63 times 10 centimeters, which is 630 centimeters, or 6.3 meters. Obviously, you can repeat this process over and over again with finer and finer resolutions, depending on how accurately you want to know the answer. If you were to measure the room to an accuracy of millimeters, you might find that its length is 6.289 meters. In actuality, we don't usually lay down rulers end to end, but, for convenience, employ appropriately long continuous tape measures or other measuring devices to relieve us of this tedious process. But the principle remains exactly the same. A tape measure or any other measuring device is simply a sequence of shorter rulers of a given standard length, such as a meter or 10 centimeters, sewed together end to end. Implicit in our measurement process, whatever it is the assumption that with increasing resolution, the result converges to an increasingly accurate fixed number, which we call the length of the room, a presumably objective property of your living room. In the example, its length converged from 6 to 6.3 to 6.289 meters as the resolution increased. This convergence to a well-defined length seems completely obvious, and indeed was not questioned for several thousand years until 1950, when Richardson stumbled upon the surprising mystery of the lengthening borders and coastlines. Let's now imagine measuring the length of the border between two neighboring countries, or the length of a country's coastline, following the standard procedure outlined above. To get a very rough estimate, we might start by using 100-mile segments laid end-to-end to cover its entire length. Suppose we find that with this resolution, the border is approximated by just over 12 such segments, so that its length is roughly a little over 1,200 miles. To get a more accurate measurement, we might then use 10-mile segments to estimate the length. According to the usual rules of measurement, articulated with the living room example, we might find something like 124 segments, leading to a better estimate of 1,240 miles. Greater accuracy could then be obtained by increasing the resolution to 1 mile, in which case we might expect to find 1,243 segments, say, leading to a value of 1,243 miles. This can be continued, using progressively finer and finer resolutions to obtain as accurate a number as needed. However, to his great surprise, Richardson found that when he carried out this standard iterative procedure using calipers on detailed maps, this simply wasn't the case. In fact, he discovered that the finer the resolution, and therefore the greater the expected accuracy, the longer the border got, rather than converging to some specific value. Unlike lengths of living rooms, the lengths of borders and coastlines continually get longer, rather than converging to some fixed number, violating the basic laws of measurement that had implicitly been presumed for several thousand years. Equally surprising, Richardson discovered that this increase in length progressed in a systematic fashion. When he plotted the length of various borders and coastlines versus the resolution used to make the measurements on a logarithmic scale, it revealed a straight line indicative of the power law scaling we've seen in many other places. This was extremely strange, as it indicated that contrary to conventional belief, these lengths seem to depend on the scale of the units used to make the measurement, and in this sense are not an objective property of what is being measured. So what's going on here? A moment's reflection and you will quickly realize what it is. Unlike your living room,